Well, you've got your diamonds, and you've got your pretty clothes, and the chauffeur drives your car. You let everybody know, but don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Pamela Constable, author of the new book, Playing with Fire, Pakistan at War with Itself. Pamela Constable is a foreign correspondent and former deputy foreign editor of The Washington Post, where she has covered South Asia from New Delhi to Kabul. Her other books include Fragments of Grace, My Search for Meaning in the Strife of South Asia, and A Nation of Enemies, Chile under Pinochet. Welcome to Background Briefing, Pamela Constable.
Glad to be here, and nice to hear Mick Jagger.
Well, I think you got the joke there, didn't you? Musical pun, Playing with Fire. I don't know where to begin, Pamela Constable. I mean, every day there's in the press there's bad news, the latest about Pakistan, I should say, the latest of which is, I think, and I know there's some massacres going on or mass murders going on in Karachi, political violence there. But just in the last few weeks, it was a couple of Pakistani businessmen were indicted for funneling ISI intelligence money into U.S. congressmen, mostly Dan Burton. So do you feel sometimes that it's unyielding, the problems and criticism of Pakistan?
Well, there's certainly relentless news coming out of Pakistan, which is one of the things that makes it very difficult to write a book about a situation that is so fluid and so evolving and that keeps producing new incidents and problems that you feel you really have to keep up with. And it was very difficult to actually complete this book. In fact, it was completed just before Osama bin Laden was killed. So it really, you tear your hair out trying to make sense of it all. But yes, to answer your question seriously, sometimes you do feel as if there are just so many problems and so many criticisms and so many tensions. You're looking for something positive to say, and I do have some positive things to say in the book, but I'm afraid they are, at least for now, outweighed by some of the negatives.
So when you talk about Pakistan at war with itself, of course you're talking about a nuclear-powered country, or nuclear-armed country, I should say, that in fact, my understanding is it's the fastest-growing nuclear arsenal in the world. It has, by some analyses, passed the number of warheads France has, and it's creeping up on the number of warheads that Britain has.
Well, you know, I'm not an expert on nuclear policy or issues. The war that I'm really talking about in Pakistan has to do with more, you know, religious and political differences and tensions that are creating enormous difficulties in what is one of the largest and will soon be of the largest Muslim country in the world, a country which has a history of moderate and tolerant views of Islam, but which is increasingly being influenced by much more radical and violent visions of Islam. And that's the war that I focus on and that I find of great concern.
But surely just the recent killing of Osama bin Laden raised some very disturbing possibilities. Number one was that the people at the top in the military and the ISI knew about it. That's been discounted by our political and military leaders. The second possibility is that people down the chain knew about it and sheltered him and perhaps saw him as some kind of an asset. And the third possibility is that nobody knew anything, which nobody believes. So if you take that second possibility, it does relate to nuclear weapons because it raises questions about command and control.
Well, that is true. And you know, the Pakistani authorities, military and civilian, have always stressed every time this issue was raised that they have firm control over the nuclear arsenal, that they would never use it irresponsibly, and that this is something that no one needs to worry about. In fact, they often say they're worried about their nuclear assets being stolen by the West and its agents. But the problem increasingly, or the concern increasingly, is that people who are not officially part of the state, people who are who wield power and influence in other arenas, including militant Islamist groups, which may have maybe some covert support or winked at by the state but are not officially supported, could in fact possibly get access to that arsenal. And that's, I think that's the greater concern.
And again, I'm speaking with Pamela Constable, author of the new book, Playing with Fire, Pakistan at War with Itself. And of course, the book is largely about the people of Pakistan, their aspirations and their sense of being trapped in a country. There's a pervasive joke that Pakistan is not a country with an army, but an army with a country. And it does seem that the choices for the average Pakistani are pretty dismal between a military government, which I don't think anybody particularly wants, although they're the only thing they have, or alternatively, civilian kleptocratic governments. And they've gone back and forth between the two. But given its feudal nature and how many votes are delivered in this feudal way, how do you really get to the heart of how people think and feel in that country? Or is it so corrupt and so controlled by the elite that nobody cares what the average Pakistani feels?
Well, you've asked about 10 questions in one.
So sorry.
Try to deal with the issues you raise. One of the issues you raised in that question is the tussle, the continual tension between civilian and military control, which is a permanent problem for Pakistan, largely because it's always been focused on its belief that India remains an existential threat to Pakistan. And so much of its focus has been on defending itself against the perceived threat from India rather than on developing its own nation economically and socially. And that's been a major problem. Another problem has been sort of what I call the curse of poor or failed leadership. Through its relatively brief history, Pakistan has suffered a series of catastrophes in terms of leadership. Some of its best leaders have been killed in office or died in office. Others have been taken over by military regimes. Others have simply proved incompetent to rule. And Pakistan really has never had a civilian government, or any government really, that has finished out its term in a peaceful succession. And there's hope that this time, even though the current government is not terribly popular, that if it does finish out its term and does hand over power peacefully to another government, that this alone would be an accomplishment. So the bar is quite low, actually. And Pakistan, again, its short history, has not really had a chance to develop the kind of mature political institutions that are needed for a thriving democracy.
But the feeling I get from your book, Pamela Constable, Playing with Fire, Pakistan at War with Itself, is since you've profiled so many people, and particularly the vast majority are so poor, and they seem so disconnected from the elite, and we only deal with the elite and hear from the elite. And I'm wondering whether at the end of the day, the only thing that the poor have is Islam.
Well, that's a main a principal theme and point of my book, which is that, you know, many Pakistanis, and again, we're talking about a country of more than 175 million people, many Pakistanis feel very alienated from the state, do not feel represented or served or protected by the state, do not feel that their opportunities have been met by the state, are frustrated that they don't get enough education, can't find jobs, can't find the basic things they need. And so, yes, in many cases, you have people turning towards Islam, and particularly Sunni Islam, and increasingly more conservative or alarming versions of Sunni Islam to satisfy their needs.
And I take it that, in terms of that, the more radical forms of Islam, you have to, I think, include surely the influence of the Saudi Arabians, don't you? Haven't they been funding I mean, I know the madrasa thing has been somewhat overplayed, but I believe that the Saudis have been funding both radicalism in Pakistan and in Afghanistan, for that matter.
Yes, this all really started with the Afghan wars against the Soviet Union in the 1980s, and of course the United States was heavily involved in that. But then after that war ended, the West pretty much withdrew from the region, and what was left in place was a much more radicalized, much more Middle Easternized infrastructure of Islamic mosques and seminaries and political parties that has been gaining influence ever since and is now giving the more moderate traditional forms of Islam a real run for their money in Pakistan.
So where do you see the lines, if you will, in terms of percentages? Or if I know it's not a very very useful thing, but I'm trying to get a handle on how small the elite is, how disconnected they are, what the percentage of the country that would be secular that is modern. I know that they have freewheeling television, and some of it's quite racy and interesting. So there are these vast contradictions. I mean, when you think about that, and then you look at the video footage the other day of the Pakistan Taliban leader haranguing these poor hapless 16 police men before they were massacred. That's another side of it. So how do you give us a projection of the relative balance between the secular and religious, between the elite and the vast majority?
Yeah, again, you're raising some complicated issues with many many aspects in the same question. You know, you've got class divisions, you've got religious divisions, you've got ethnic and linguistic divisions. You've got a whole series of what sociologists and political scientists call cleavages in that society, all of which play upon each other. And essentially, you have a westernized elite that is not terribly concerned about the plight of the poor, and that has, you know, I think, neglected the poor at its own peril for a very long time. You have this rising, more radicalized group of parties and individuals and leaders that are, you know, having enormous influence on the thinking and feelings of the poor, who feel left out of the opportunities that a country like Pakistan ought to be able to provide. You have a number of different issues of ethnic violence. You have this growing demographic time bomb of a very fast growing population that cannot be supported much longer by the infrastructure and the economic size of the state. So you have, I guess, what you'd call sort of multiple crises coming closer and closer together, and I'm not sure that the leadership is really in a position, you know, to know what to do about this. I mean, of course there's corruption, there are a number of other problems, but the real issue is one of, you know, leaders rising to an occasion, confronting the issues that exist squarely, and calling on the nation to help them do something about it.
Well, of course, Pamela Constable, you can't help somebody who doesn't want to help themselves. And I suppose that raises the question about what the U.S. is doing. And we've concentrated on military aid. But then recently there was the Kerry-Lugar bill, but that was greeted in Pakistan, particularly by the ISI-influenced press, as some kind of encroachment by Blackwater, and all this hysteria went on. So one would not think on the American side they may feel like it's looking the gift horse in the mouth. But on the other hand, here in the United States, I think we could open up and buy some more of their cotton, and there's probably domestic political reasons why we don't. So what do you think in terms of the future? What can we do and what are we doing?
Well, again, you're asking so much.
I know.
I will do my best here.
Well, I'm trying to get everybody to understand what the book's about, and I'm trying to do it in a very quick and economical way.
I do appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to say. I mean, there are issues of import tariffs on textiles and apparel. That's one issue right there. With U.S.-Pakistan relations, there are the growing tensions between allied military and intelligence establishments that need to be somehow fixed. There's a great deal of mistrust now between these two allies that needs to somehow be repaired. But you know, if there's one thing that I think really needs to happen on both sides of the aisle, you know, when people ask me what I think Pakistan needs most, I always say education, because if you can educate that populace, if you can get people to have a clearer sense of their own opportunities and their own rights and their own capacities, that country can take off like a rocket. There's no reason that Pakistan should not be able to develop and progress at the pace of a Turkey or a Mexico or a Bangladesh or an India. There's just no reason that this can't happen, and it really should happen. And I think if there's anything that the West can do, aside from strict economic relations, it's to encourage encourage the kind of exchanges that help people on both sides of the ocean have a clearer understanding of these misperceptions and the mistrust. I mean, Pakistanis, many, many, many Pakistanis really believe that the West is out to get them, is out to destroy their religion, their way of life, which I don't think is true, but it really needs to be challenged, and it really needs, people really need to have a clearer understanding of what's at stake and who their friends are and who their enemies are.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Pamela Constable.
It's my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Pamela Constable, author of the new book, Playing with Fire, Pakistan at War with Itself. Pamela Constable is a foreign correspondent and former deputy foreign editor for The Washington Post. She has covered South Asia from New Delhi to Kabul. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank my producers, Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. Our theme music is One Time, One Night by Los Lobos. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. And I'll be back tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.